Hello and welcome back to the Change It podcast with me, Eloise Seidelin.
We don't leave the house and put on our robot costume, come to work and suddenly we don't have emotions and feelings. We're still real people. That's why trust is such a key enabler for transformation. It helps people get focused and rely on each other and deliver great things. And without that, it can be really, really exhausting for the individuals, but also for, you know, everyone involved over time.
Today I have a fantastic conversation in store for you. I'm very excited for you to wrap your ears around this. So we have Sarah Duffy, who is the Global Head of Change at Seek, on the show, and Sarah is talking about trust in transformation. This is a conversation I feel incredibly lucky to share and to have been privy to. I hope you enjoy the episode. Sarah, welcome to the Change It podcast. It's an absolute delight to have you here with me today.
Thank you for having me.
I am super pumped for our conversation today around trust in transformation. This keeps emerging. But before we delve straight into business, I would love to hear who you are, Sarah, and what you do, please.
I am leading Seek's APAC change practice, which aims to enable Seek, an international organization, to deliver on its change agendas. But before that, I've done a raft of different roles and started my career in the strategy consulting space, helping organizations identify ways to achieve profitable growth. And what I found through that process was we'd be sending these recommendations and I'd always be like, what happens next? Are they going to get this right? And inevitably, the business leaders would struggle because while developing a new business direction or strategy is hard, the people side of delivering that is even harder because you're dealing with conflicting priorities, fears, resource constraints, misalignment, the list, lots of different reasons for why things can get in the way of delivering a business strategy. And so I've devoted the rest of my career, about 10-ish years, to delivering business results with people.
Amazing. And that's an amazing narrative to have kind of come through that journey to get into a seat where you're really bringing about very human change across globally, in fact, isn't it, Seek?
Yeah, that's right. And that's my purpose. How, and I know there's many other people probably tuning in today looking for the same thing. How do we create change experiences where people feel like change is not done to them, but it's done with them? They have an opportunity to provide input, co-create solutions, and feel heard so that we increase the chance of that change being successfully delivered. And that it's just a better experience for people. So, yeah, come join me on my mission to create people-centric approaches to change.
Before we delve into the role of trust and how that kind of plays into this, I'd love to dial this back and zoom out into you as a person outside of business. What lights you up? What do you do for fun, Sarah?
What don't I do for fun? I do everything. I have two young kids, so I don't have a huge amount of time. Most of my fun happens within my local area, but we love to sing and dance in the living room, play banjo with my 18-month-old. And when the days are hot, we love a bit of a sprinkler party. And for those on the call that live in different countries, a sprinkler is basically an attachment to a hose to water your garden. But in Australia, on hot days, people like to run under it and squeal with delight as we feel this refreshing rain fall on us on a hot day. So yeah, definitely a worthwhile activity if you experience a hot day yourself.
Makes me think I need to put up my shopping list for Christmas for Roman, actually. Sprinkler parties. I think one of the other things that maybe we can't see on this because people are listening to us is the way you turn up. You are a colour bomb and a rainbow in a grey space, Sarah, like certainly when I met for our first meeting in Melbourne. I was kind of very basic and black, and I'm wearing black again today. But you definitely inspired me to wear a bit more colour.
I'm so proud of you. Yes. Look, at the end of the day, the reason why I do that is I want to model the importance of being able to express our true selves. I've experienced situations where I haven't, and I found that really hard and exhausting. And so you can wear black if you want to. The most important thing is that you feel you can freely express yourself. So do it your way.
I love that. And I think that's really important segue into the conversation that we're going to have today around trust and safety and feeling psychologically safe, which is something that's coming up a lot across Australia, particularly. I think we're ahead of the curve there. Before we go delve into this conversation, when we talk trust, it's a huge word and potentially can mean different things to different people. As we talk about trust today, like, how do you define trust in the workplace?
So trust is something that's held by individuals in an organization, and it's that belief in the reliability and capability of someone or something. So it's that sense of belief. It could be in the organization or in others that we work with. So what does that look like or feel like? Usually how I like to think about it is there's kind of three different dimensions: the trust in the organization. So this sense that the organization will do the right thing by people and its customers, even during hard times. And so what that looks like is a sense of confidence, like how people talk around the water cooler, even during tough times, that they will see things through. And that's usually reinforced through the organizational processes, the capability of leadership in talking about their business strategy and how they'll work through more turbulent times. So there's trust in the organization, trust in the plan. So usually as a team or a transformation function, you are delivering towards a plan, and there's that trust that the plan is achievable and it's not going to burn us out. And a sense that, which this always happens in, particularly in large scale technology implementations, the scope, you get to that point where you're like, oh, wow, this is more complex than we thought. There's disciplines in place for the business to think about, well, what are we going to do to ensure that this is a success? What trade-offs are we going to make, whether it's cost, timing, or quality? So trust in the plan and the practices to ensure that things are successfully delivered. And then trust in each other, which is my favorite topic. And it's that sense that the people that we work directly with are reliable, they're capable, so they're dependable, and they're not going to cause us any harm. And I don't mean harm as in physical harm. When we interact with those people, we feel psychologically safe and that we feel free to share our views without fear of judgment, that we can seek support and people will in turn provide that support, whether it's like helping turn around a document or providing expertise. So yeah, it really, really depends on what lens we're taking: trust in the organization, the plan, and the people, and what are the things that underpin that to ensure that all three are in place.
That's awesome. And that's holistic, right? It gives a view as to the accountability holistically for trust. Brené talks about trust being built in many small moments and how you can kind of like, you have to consistently show up to have that feeling of trust. And I think what you're talking to there when you talk about kind of the individual and your peers is it is in those daily interactions, those water cooler moments, rather than a one-off conversation. Trust isn't like an instant thing. It's built over time.
For sure. And one of the best examples I have of that is when I worked for an HR consultancy. And when I joined, we'd just gone through the global financial crisis, which was quite a stressful experience for a lot of management consultants. Many of the larger organizations were feeling a lot of pressure on their profitability and were quick to make wide-scale redundancies. Now, this organization recognized the strength of consultancies was having great people, committed people and capable people. And so they did whatever they could to protect their people from redundancies. And everyone in the organization made sacrifices, whether it was time out, reducing their hours and pay. And there was also this story going around that the CEO of the ANZ practice had taken a significant amount of time without pay. And that gave people this sense of trust in each other, that they were seen as reliable and looking out for each other to minimize harm for each other. But importantly, it wasn't just after the GFC, but the continual practices of that organization, including sharing the business results in a transparent way, asking people to do specific things to ensure that we continually met our financial targets. And importantly, the leadership signs and signals that they were being cost conscious as well to minimize harm when things were going tough. And one of my favorite examples of that was that same CEO would always, now she wouldn't sit in a fancy corner office with all these expensive hardware and things. She would sit amongst us and would often be the last person to have her laptop replaced because of that sense of, I'll do whatever it takes to minimize kind of costs, pressures on the organization. And I just loved that. It was just a really, really practical and relevant example of how you can build trust in the organization as well as each other, even during hard times.
Yeah, that cohesive environment where it's like we all muck in, we're equal.
Exactly. And we've all been in organizations when that's also not the case, where maybe management is asking people to do a particular thing and then they're not actually acting consistently with that. We often see that in the news as well. And that erodes trust in the people working in the organization too. So yeah, it's important that leaders model what they are asking of others.
And so on the flip side then, where do you think that, I don't want to say it's systemic, though at times it can feel it depending on the place that you are viewing the market from or your world from, right? Your peripheral tilts based on the place that you're operating within. So where do you think a lack of trust can stem from? How does that impact the landscape of transformation?
So I think it depends on who we're asking, right? So for customers, there's that erosion of trust where we feel like the organization isn't acting in our best interest. And we've seen some recent examples of that in the media where organizations have cut their customer experience so much for the short-term profits that the, you know, customers' experiences have suffered as a result. Often we see it when organizations are going through difficult times again, and it creates these stories around, well, how did we treat our people during financial times? Did we protect their interests? Did we already have practices in place that meant we were able to weather the storm? Yeah, so I think that's another example. And then trust in each other is, in transformation programs, they're a perfect pressure cooker. Often you're bringing lots of people together from many different organizations with different personalities, and how do we treat each other when we're in that pressure cooker? Does that create unnecessary stress for us, or are we actually looking out for each other? So it really depends on where you're standing in the organization or outside the organization around how that trust can erode. But there's lots of great examples of it, and there's also many not so great examples of it. And the importance is consistency. Like, it takes, I think to your point earlier, it's not a flash in the pan activity. Let's build trust through communication or leadership upskilling program. It's a ongoing commitment to do the right thing and have processes in place to serve the best interests of our customers, our people, and our shareholders.
Mm. And so do you have some practices that you recommend to support the growth and retention of trust?
One of the ways in which we can build trust is with each other. At the end of the day, organizations are, by definition, a group of people trying to achieve something together. So to build trust in each other, I think in today's world, we're increasingly working in hybrid or distributed teams. And that's certainly the case for me. I'm, as our leading a transformation at the moment, we've got about 20 practitioners across 7 countries. And so having team routines and rituals in place to consistently build trust with each other is really important, as well as investing the time up front to build deep connections with each other and understand the person behind the computer screen. So some of the things that we do at Seek is using strengths-based assessments, have an appreciation for the different strengths and styles of individuals within the team so that we can appreciate when we're under that pressure cooker, people might express themselves in different ways or have different needs. And while that might create kind of tension within the team, that tension is because of natural differences, not because we're kind of good or bad or have the wrong intentions. Mm-hmm. So appreciating the different styles and how they might play out under pressure is really, really valuable, as well as how to draw in the different strengths of the team so people feel valued and that they can rely on the strengths of others.
I think that is an amazing tool that you guys have implemented that talks as a positive framing in and of itself, in opposition to like a Myers-Briggs, where I've had personally actually had examples of that being kind of almost used against me in organizations where they've kind of like seen there to be like a best answer to that, which contradicts the means, doesn't it? But I think that that's amazing that you guys at Seek are leading into something like strengths. I'm going to sound like a Brené fangirl, but she just springs to mind when I think of this. But like she talks about we're all just trying to do our best. Mm-hmm. Or like even bad situations, if there's a moment where we're disagreeing with someone, if we can just think they're just trying to do their best with what they have, with where they are, then it really helps us kind of dial back anything that's firing up. And thinking of that in the context of strengths, I can see that in situations of conflict or disagreement, it kind of can help you pull back and get a more consolidated kind of view.
Yeah, collaborate with empathy. Another thing that others might find useful is a weekly ritual that we have across our APAC change practice, where we check in with each other, because by checking in, we have that sense of connection and empathy. An example of that is we use a thing called a slider. So on a scale to 10, what's your vibe today? And that allows those that are on the higher end of the scale to share their wins and kind of call out some of the successes of the team, which is terrific. Mm. And equally for those that are lower at the scale, we can say, oh, what's going on there? What stresses or pressures are you facing? And how can we better support you as a team member too? So again, that's another example of how do you build those team routines and rituals to have empathy towards each other and connect regularly as a team.
That's amazing, particularly with a global team as well. What do you do then, I suppose, if someone turns up as a one?
Yeah. So when people are at the lower end, and that's highlighted through team sessions or perhaps even their nonverbal signals, it's about just showing care, right? And I think sometimes when someone's feeling really low, they may not feel as comfortable talking about the reasons for that. It could be personal reasons, not just work reasons. And so creating a safe space through kind of one-on-one interactions is normally useful at times.
Amazing. What about more broadly then, if we think about trust in the organization, so moving away from the individual and the person to the organization, what do you do well, or what have you seen done well here as an organization to build that trust?
I've worked in many different organizations, and the things that I see done well in terms of building trust is transparent sharing of the performance of the organization and what tactics are in place to ensure profitable growth, or that the organization will see itself through hard times. Like leaders being transparent and consistent in how they talk to that. Importantly, having processes in place that give people confidence around the financial management of the organization. So getting a sense that they do put effective controls in place to protect themselves from what I call margin erosion, where when perhaps your customer, your profitability is dropping, that you've got a great cost base to protect yourself when revenues are down. And importantly, the stories that are created through historical experiences. For example, if that organization had a near-death experience, but then management were able to bring together the right people and turn things around, or perhaps there was a terrific story around how the organization allowed itself to differentiate itself from the competitors to ensure it was more successful. These stories, like being shared around the organization to create beliefs across people that, yeah, we're doing all right. We're doing the right thing by our people. We're doing it, the right thing by our customers. And we have these capabilities in place to see things through.
I'm reading Jim Collins' Good to Great book at the moment, and he talks about that common belief. And once you can instill that and you believe it, then it is powerful, I can imagine, in an organization, particularly when you talk trust.
And one of my mantras is, experiencing is believing. So organizations that have long tenured workforces that have lived through different economic cycles, they tend to have that deep sense of belief around the organization's capability and integrity to see things through and do the right thing. Whereas when you have kind of high turnover or you're in a high growth, perhaps people don't have that degree of certainty because they haven't experienced it yet. And so, yeah, it's an interesting thing, being able to communicate your direction versus people directly experiencing it is, yeah, the latter is so much more powerful.
So we've covered trust in the individual and then trust in the organization. And what about trust in the plan?
Yeah, trust in the plan is around this deep sense that whatever plan you're working towards is achievable. We've all been in that situation where I think Jim Collins calls it the big, hairy, audacious goal. Like, it needs to be ambitious enough that it gives people excitement and hope, but it's not too much of a stress that people go, oh, that's not achievable. I'm not even going to bother because I'm set up to fail. And we often see this in transformations. There's this scoping activity that happens in place and you develop this plan. We're going to deliver this in X amount of time. And the people that are involved in implementation of that need to have confidence or a sense of belief that that plan is achievable and they're not going to get burnt out in the process. And importantly, when you get further on into delivering that business strategy or that transformation and things might seem more complex, there are disciplines in place to go, all right, well, what are we going to do to deliver this now? We realize there's more to be done. Are we going to throw more resources at it? Are we going to de-scope? Are we going to change the timeline? Are we going to invest in bringing people in? Whatever that is, having a sense that, all right, the plan is achievable, and if we realize that maybe it's harder than we thought, we've got the processes in place to ensure that we're on track and we're not burning people in the process.
So that kind of recontracting, Daryl Connor's recontracting, and kind of like setting up a contract but then constant review and having a safe space within which to call out that the plan isn't working or we're completely off piece and we're not going to hit said deadline for go live.
Yeah, and we've all been there, right, when it hasn't, when you're like, oh my gosh, is this actually feasible? Well, we're going to keep pretending that this is going to be, anyway, and as change practitioners, we often feel that where, oh wow, this is an ambitious timeline. I reckon the build phase is going to get delayed and then the amount to kind of equip people and train people is going to get squished. But I'm proud to say at Seek we don't do things that way. We're very considerate in how we give people enough space and time and support to prepare for change, which is great.
I'm sure you're probably going to have lots of job applications after this podcast airs. What about the burnout piece? Because you touched on that there. And I think that that's a really pertinent conversation for people that are listening to this that are in situations where they're floundering, right, to meet the go live. And it's inevitable that sometimes in transformation, you know, 3-4 days out, it is all hands on deck for a moment in time. And sometimes people do really stretch themselves. But if that continues, how do you as an individual deal with that with trust? I think it's very difficult, because will you feel a sense of trust to even air the fact you are feeling like this?
Yeah. So I'm a big geek when it comes to measurement. So what data based insights can we get around burnout? And so things like, most organizations do employee engagement surveys, using them as a source of truth around how people are feeling and whether engagement's dipping and what's contributing to that. And equally running listening sessions with teams to get an understanding, are there any common sources of stress or burnout that the organization can minimize or prevent? It's too often I see this knee-jerk reaction to, we need to put people on well-being training, and you know, that might give people some armor to face into the war of stress, but how do we actually minimize that stress by looking at what are the recurring stresses or things that are impacting people? And it might be workload. So that, therefore, what are we doing in our planning processes to reduce workload or improve resourcing? It might be interpersonal stress. So how are we improving the interactivity of teams? I mean, it can be all kinds of things, but I think having a data-informed view around burnout is a good place to start.
Okay, so that's really interesting. When you're talking about being a geek for the data and the metrics involved, like, that fascinates me, because I think this is a huge piece. It brings the metrics. What do you use or recommend for capturing data and providing those metrics?
So many organizations have engagement surveys. So one of the ways in which we can get measures is to work with our engagement survey partner to understand what might be some well-being indicators. And if they don't exist, they normally have a bank of questions to provide that kind of baseline, and then to see where people are improving or dropping. When I was at BlueScope, we were going through a transformation and knew that that was a key risk. And so we used a well-being profiler by Benny Button, and it was pretty cool. It highlighted, empowered people to complete a self-assessment, which gave them a report, so they were empowered to understand what was working and where there were areas of drain or risk. But importantly, as a leadership team, we were able to roll that data up at a cohort level to see common patterns, risks, and opportunities across the group to better protect our teams from burnout. And a practical example of that was a lot of people, a source of potential well-being risk for them was lack of certainty around their next role, which is really common in transformation programs. People have these kind of career-changing experiences they often put on a secondment, and then they're like, oh, where to from here? Like, my team structure has changed, or someone's been filling in for me. What does that mean for me? And so we were able to have a very targeted approach, ensuring that leaders were having one-on-ones with their team members and giving them a level of certainty around their career plan, which therefore reduced the risk of burnout. Now, if we did the typical thing, which is we'll just put people on a general well-being program, that may not have hit the mark, because the source of burnout risk was very specific. And so by having that data-informed view, we were able to do something that was going to make a meaningful difference to that specific group in that specific context.
I think that's amazing. And it was some time ago that you were at BlueScope, so that seems like it was really cutting edge in terms of creating a vision, even kind of.
Yeah, it was inspiring stuff. And shout out to a lot of the people in our well-being network who worked to embed some of these practices. It was very inspiring and fulfilling work.
I think that from a well-being perspective, it's amazing to do something like that as well. In Johan Hari's book recently, Stolen Focus, he talks about some of the well-being, go and meditate, take time out in your day, being like saying to those that are dealing with severe poverty to go and eat at a five-star restaurant. It's really misplaced for the environment. And if someone is operating with two jobs and struggling to keep a roof over their head, to tell them to take some time out or not get stressed, and stress is just a figment of your imagination, is so misplaced.
Exactly. And that's something, it's valuable for people to have a level of personal resilience in the workplace, but I think organizations and communities and governments also have a responsibility to think about what stress are they putting on people in their community or organization? What are those sources of stress or burnout, and how can they prevent them if they're linked to organizational or community practices? It's got to be a multifaceted approach. It can't just rest with one individual to put on some armor and survive in a very challenging environment.
It is on us as a collective. Exactly. That burnout, or those high levels of stress that we're operating in, where we're really at our threshold, can lead to this erosion of trust, and potentially across all three dimensions that you've discussed, across the organization, across the plan, and across the individual. It could percolate across all three if the levels of burnout and fatigue are that great. How do you address and recalibrate trust where you're seeing a stakeholder or team member or even a sponsor demonstrating signs of burnout?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I firstly encourage people to have a look at research-based sources. So, for example, Beyond Blue, an Australian organisation, provides examples of what burnout looks like and feels like. It can often result in interpersonal conflict, because people that are facing burnout can often be quite irritable, drained, perhaps lack motivation to do their work. They might become more isolated. So team members that are interacting with them are suddenly going, oh, what's going on here? This person is hard work. Or they might say something due to their kind of irritability that might harm someone, right? Hurt their feelings. And that can result in the erosion of trust, because, as I mentioned earlier, trust is the kind of set of belief that a individual or organization is reliable and will not harm us. And so ways in which you can do that is kind of channeling our inner Brené Brown and leaning into that vulnerability and sharing with the individual in a safe environment. Normally kind of go for a walk and talk. You don't want to be kind of facing them directly, because that can result in defensive behavior or elicit a threat response. But instead, kind of go for a walk and share with the individual, I've noticed you haven't been yourself lately. Share some specific examples, just in case there were other things going on in your world that I wasn't aware of. How can I help you? You can point them to resources if your organization has an EAP or burnout. But sometimes for a lot of people, it's just the awareness that of the impact that they're having on others is enough for them to take action, because it's not something that happens overnight. It's normally an erosion of kind of energy and well-being. And so having someone kind of put the mirror up to them is really, really important. And sometimes that's not me as the kind of messenger or leader. It could be someone else within their network that they trust, and letting those people know who can have a vulnerable or a meaningful conversation. Knowing your role in the ecosystem of trust and well-being is really important. I've had people do that for me as well when I have not been myself. It's been a hard truth, but so important, because by having that self-awareness, then we can do something about it.
I think it's profound that it's a very human approach, Sarah, and I think it's something that's really accessible for us all to be able to think, yeah, actually ask that person what's going on for them. What is going on outside of this moment and outside of work? Is there something bigger? That's something that we can all think to do. And Now I ask everyone that comes on the show, do you remember a question that you either like to ask people to ascertain you're going to hire them, or have been asked within an interview to ascertain that you want to go there? What profound interview question sticks with you?
Oh, so many. I would say one that I really like to ask is, what sort of culture team culture do you thrive in? And then on the flip side, what sort of team culture do you feel like you are frustrated? And that's because while change practitioners and others can have really terrific technical competence, if they're not in an environment where they feel they're going to be able to flourish, they can quickly struggle. And so it doesn't mean that I would put a line against someone that may not align exactly to the kind of team environment, but having an appreciation for what they need helps you, even if they're the successful candidate, then you can ensure that they have a really good onboarding and coaching experience. And a really terrific example of that is, like, in change management, some corporate organizations take a really structured approach to change, and others are a lot more adaptive and agile, and it can feel a bit more ambiguous for people. So getting a sense of the sort of environment that they thrive in can help understand any key risks like that.
I love that, both for the fact that you're considering it up front to get to know them as a person, and that's a character piece, but also to weave that into the onboarding experience and to have that, like, very human, I've remembered this about you, must also really increase their, like, feeling of belonging and inclusion straight up, which is amazing. My final question that I like to ask everyone on the show is, what golden nugget, what one piece of wisdom would you like to leave ringing in everyone's ear that has listened to the show today?
It would be something that I learned from my mum, which was, be the change you want to see in the world. That's what you'll be remembered for, which was actually not from my mum, I've since learned, was from Gandhi, who is one of the most admirable change catalysts in our history on earth.
But delivered well by your mum.
Delivered great by mum.
That is such a lovely, lovely, heartwarming place to leave it. A quote from Sarah's mum. Thank you ever so much for this very, very human conversation. I've really enjoyed having you on the show and can't wait to do it again.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Change It podcast today. Wow, what a conversation that really resonated. It might be worth a double listen for how much there was to unpack within that, the three dimensions of trust and transformation. Put simply, be the change in the world that you want to see. Very powerful. Don't forget to tune in a month's time when I will have Tim Creasy on the show sharing the top trends in change across organisations from a huge piece of research that they've done at ProSci. He actually returns for a 3-part series. Tim will be deep diving with us on the Change It podcast. Be sure not to miss it. Please do hit subscribe and share with your friends. Your word and recommendation goes further than you think.